Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island Beer Company, a Chicago craft brewery that works to innovate new ways to brew and age beer. More at gooseisland.com. You don't need to be the only beer you drink. We just want to be the best beer you drink.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and Greg, we are going to devote this episode to Tom Petty. Died at the age of 66 on October 2 in Los Angeles, where he'd been living for a very long time. We had him in the studio for 2 hours talking about music in 2003. We'll be drawing from that interview throughout this show, and also giving our own thoughts on a rocker I think we both agree generally underrated, despite a 40-year career and dozens of songs that resonate with people from all generations.
Yeah, absolutely, Jim. I mean, we have an artist who sold 80 million records and is underrated. How is that possible? But I think in some cases it was because Petty, you know, created this very narrow vision of what to him was rock and roll and hewed to it throughout 40 years. Guitar, bass, drums, vocals, and not much else. He wrote about 40, 50 songs that as soon as you write the titles down, you remember what they are. You want to hum a few lines. It's sort of like John Fogerty of Creedence Clearwater Revival.
That's a good comparison.
This kind of journeyman rocker who ended up writing these songs that really define people's lives.
Journeyman is a word that a lot of people frown upon because it just means a workaday person, right, who does a great job but isn't a superstar. I think that's Tom Petty, but mainly because he was so laconic and laid back and kind of just hangdog in a very southern way. Mm-hmm. Born in Gainesville, Florida, grew up there. The southern part never left him. He was very aware of his southern heritage, even though the music he really loved was California pop music. You know, the Beatles, but the Beatles as filtered through the Birds. I think that Rickenbacker, that chiming guitar sound. And though he loved bass guitars, drums, and let's not forget Ben Montench's keyboards, it was more from a sense of this is my palette, and I can write songs here that are timeless. They could have been written in 1967 or 2017.
Absolutely. And I think one of the more endearing aspects of Tom Petty, why he was so relatable to so many people. Like, I could have a beer with that guy, even though I just paid $50 to go see him at a stadium, was because he was a fan first and foremost. And he never lost that yen, that spirit, that enthusiasm when he would talk about the people that inspired him. And in that 2003 interview, he talked about meeting Elvis Presley as a kid.
Yeah, that's a staggering event in my life. You know, it was kind of cosmic when I look at it now, and it's almost cliched, but, you know, when I was a kid around 61, I guess I was like 11 years old, and I had an uncle who you know, kind of developed film and was in the film business somewhat in Gainesville, Florida. It's not a huge film, but he liked to film. He filmed the football.
Hollywood East,
you know,
yeah.
Football practice, you know.
Right.
But he got hired onto an Elvis movie for in some capacity. And my aunt, I remember sitting under a pine tree with no particular thought at all, you know, at 11 years old, and my aunt pulls in and says, you want to go see Elvis Presley, you know? And I had this vague memory of Elvis Presley, you know, of some controversy in the household when I was 5 or 6 about someone who wiggled.
Yeah, a little dangerous.
But that's all, you know, and then I thought, well, I've never seen a famous person. I think I'll go, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I went, and there was this enormous, you know, super Elvis mania in the streets kind of thing, you know. But I'd never seen in my life, you know. I guess no one had.
Yeah.
And I really remember that, and I remember him coming in a white Cadillac. There were 5 or 6 white Cadillacs. And all these guys getting out with, like, sharkskin suits, you know.
The Memphis Mafia, yeah.
And they all have black pompadours and sharkskin suits, you know. And I had never seen anything like that, you know. And I kept saying, well, which one's Elvis? And then suddenly you go, that one's Elvis, you know. And he came over and he said hello, you know, and we were dutifully marched out with our uncle, you know, and my cousins, and he said hi, and this then just went into his trailer. You know?
And, oh well,
which I can completely understand. You know,
it's not like he gave you the special guitar and the blessing on the head and said, "Go forth and rock, my son."
It's not what you'd call a conversation. No. But you know, after that, while Elvis is in the trailer, you know, I get pretty excited, you know, and because there are crowds of girls at the chain link fence and they're all waving records, you know. And eventually he came out and they'd pass the records over the fence to somebody and they'd pass them to Elvis and he'd sign them and they'd pass them back, you know. And I thought at that moment, wow, if I just had a record, I could approach Elvis and get his autograph, you know.
Yeah.
So he was there for about a week, and so when I went home, I set about this huge search to find a record, having no money whatsoever. I finally hit gold with this guy down the street who had a sister who had gone to college in the 50s, and she had the famous box in my life that had every great rock and roll single, you know. And I had the Whammo slingshot, you know, the one that goes around your wrist and you fire it made of aluminum. I traded the slingshot. This is all true. I traded the slingshot for this box of records. I never went back to see Elvis, but the records themselves completely changed my life. It was all I did from then till now. Yeah. You know, all I did was play that music.
Hey, baby, I ain't asking what you.
And I played it. You know, my parents were concerned about me and stuff because I lost any interest
in anything
sports,
else.
Anything, you know. This is all I did.
Yeah.
I didn't play an instrument. I just listened.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't play an instrument until many years later. Well, several years later when the Beatles came, suddenly everybody in the neighborhood had a guitar because it was so clear, like, this is a way out.
Right. Well, the Great American Garage exploded.
Right. When the Beatles came along,
did
they blow away Elvis as far as you're concerned?
Completely.
Was it the whole new thing?
Yeah, because he had I Want to Hold Your Hand, and I remember the same week he came out with something like Kentucky Rain or something like, you know, the cold. Or no, it was Kissin' Cousin was his new single. I mean,
it was
really black and white.
Well, I've got a gal, she's as cute as she can be. She's a distant cousin, but she's not too distant with me.
He was out, done, through.
Yeah.
And so was everything else that wasn't a Beatle, or from England. It really was that quick, and it was this magical thing. You know, I tried to explain it to my kids, like, there was no music press, you know. There was no way to tell us about it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a bicycle would pass you, and you'd hear Beatles Sunday night.
Mm.
Sunday night Beatles. You know, weren't even sure what Beatles were. But that's how everybody came to be watching it Sunday night. Is there was just some groundswell of
on Sullivan.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles.
And the whole nation was sitting there Sunday night, and things were never the same, you know.
Close your eyes, and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Remember, I'll always be.
Now, there's a story that goes, your dad was so upset with the fact that you were not doing well in school that some of those valuable records you're talking about got smashed because of that.
He destroyed them one night. He just thought I'd lost my mind, you know. And
this was when you were about how old?
12. And he was kind of a jerk, you know. I mean, to be honest, I mean, it was kind of a jerky thing to do. But, you know, he kind of smashed them. And then my mom gave me some dough to replace them, but I bought all different records, you know.
Yeah. Because so, you were moving on.
Yeah, but it was a serious thing. They thought I'd gone kind of cuckoo.
That was Tom Petty talking to Greg and me. I apparently had not yet hit puberty, Greg, back in 2003 when we did that incredible two-hour interview with Tom Petty. You know, the enthusiasm of a rock fan. You know, we were so excited to be sitting with one of our heroes. He is recalling how excited he was meeting Elvis, obviously, and later we talked to him about George Harrison and Bob Dylan. He had been in several bands, starting when he was a teenager. He got his first guitar in 1962, grew his hair long. His dad, as we heard, did not approve. One band, the Sundowners, in the mid-60s. Mudcrutch is the first band that I think he was serious about. Got started in 1970, included two notable members, guitarist Mike Campbell and keyboardist Ben Montench.
I live on the west side by the county reservoir. And she lives down on Depot Street behind the city hall. Behind the city hall. My father's name.
But they just could not get it together in the studio. Petty gets a solo deal and he begins recording and he winds up going back to these two guys he was friends with. They knew the same musical language. We had Ben Montench as a guest on Sound Opinions not long ago. Mike Campbell, the guitarist. The Heartbreakers form around that first record deal. 1976, self-titled debut, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
So come on, baby, let's go.
And they score some singles. Breakdown makes its way on the radio. It's not a huge hit, but Petty is on the map. Unwisely, he had signed a very poor songwriting deal, and much of the money that was due him, he had to fight for years and years to get back.
I think the record company didn't quite know how to market Tom Petty at the time, and it was illustrated by that first album cover where they had Tom posing in a leather jacket with a bandolier around his
this was new wave
shoulder. That seems to be a running joke in the band's history, that first album cover, and Tom Petty laughed about it in that 2003 interview.
I blame that entirely on Stan Lynch, our drummer, the first Heartbreakers drummer. You know, he was wearing this belt of some kind of machine gun shells or something.
And, wow, that's scary.
Yeah,
he was kind of a scary guy.
Yeah, he still is. And we were, I mean that, and all, with all love and whatever,
all that LA stuff.
Stan, you know. But, you know, he said, oh, here, and try this, and he took his belt off and threw it over my shoulder. And, you know, the photographer thought, oh, hey, that's good. Mm. Let's get a couple of them. And, you know, being naive and just hit town sort of thing.
Yeah.
The new kid
that's
in LA.
The one they're going to use.
I went for it, and that's the one they use. Yeah. So forever I've had to.
And you became a punk rock new waver as a result of that image.
Just because I had the motorcycle jacket on. And, they immediately associated us with punk rock. And there's even a record somebody showed me that came out in 76 or 77 that one side of it, it's from, you know, some Scandinavian country or something, and one side is Ramones and one side is us, you know.
Wow.
As if they had, you know. So, and they put us on tours with, you know.
But there was still, there was a similar value. You guys were stripping away the elaborate. You were getting back to a basic...
Yes,
rock
absolutely.
Sound, the basic energy.
We all have the same sort of romantic notion about, you know, making things pure again in the world of rock and roll. But, you know, we weren't really what you'd call a punk rock group. I mean, in the classic sense.
Yeah.
So I always had the feeling that that new wave term came up because they didn't know where to put us and a few others, you know.
Right.
They didn't really know where to drop us.
Right.
We weren't Fleetwood Mac, you know, but we weren't the Sex Pistols. So they invented this corny term, new wave, which can mean anything.
Right. What did Lester Bangs say about your first album?
I can quote it. He said, "These guys are so wet behind their ears, you take scuba gear to get through side two. Yeah.
I remember, you know, I was just a kid starting to review records, and, you know, the Ramones and the Clash and the Patti Smith were who we were paying attention to. And Patti was sort of a piece, of a part of that conversation. Even though I'm not sure he wanted to be part of it, his record company certainly thought, oh, this maybe this is a way to market the guy. They certainly looked the part on the cover of that record. But then, as you mentioned, a song like Breakdown, where does that fit in with what's going on now? It, you know, as I said, minor hit. But, you know, I would say with those first couple of records that Patti made around that time, he was very much in the pocket of what became later known as New Wave. He was writing these really terse blasts of unapologetic rock and roll and, you know, bringing a sensibility to it that made it total sense. If he wants to go on tour with somebody like Elvis Costello at the time, who's also viewed as a punk rocker, or Patti Smith or Mink DeVille or The Clash, it made total sense. Here's an example of what I'm talking about from the second album, a track called I Need to Know from Tom Petty in 1978.
We'll talk on the streets as you may go solo. Good friend of mine say leaving by your back door. I need to know, I need to know. If you think you're gonna leave, then you better say so.
I Need to Know by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers from their second album, You're Gonna Get It, 1978. What are your memories of Tom Petty and his music? Call and leave us a message on our hotline, 888-859-1800. We'll continue our tribute to Tom Petty after a short break on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.